Hi, everybody. I have an interview coming up in a minute with Phil Watt, who is an interesting guy. You've actually heard him very briefly on the show before if you listen to Skeptico, because I played an interview he had with Gordon White about magic as part of the interview I did with Dean Radin with his move towards magic. Magic, magic, magic. Everyone's talking about chaos magic these days. I don't get it, you know? I mean, I get it on the Gordon White, we're all doing magic level, but I think there's a lot that needs to be kind of sorted out there from a more skeptical perspective, as I like to bring to things. Anyways, I really enjoyed the openness of Phil and having a discussion that covered a lot of different topics, chaos magic and Tony Robbins and money and climate change and so many different topics. So it was super fun for me. I think it came out pretty well. I hope you enjoy it. Today we welcome Philip J. Watt to Skeptico. Phil is an interesting guy and a fellow podcaster, which is always fun for me. He's also quite a spiritual seeker, as you'll come to know. He's a former social worker down there in Australia, which brings an interesting background to the mix. He's an out-of-body traveler, a lucid dreamer, a bunch of other stuff. And you can add to that list an author of a very cool new book titled The Simulation. So, Phil, we're here to do a redo on a pretty good interview we did last time, but we both wanted to take it a little bit further. So thanks for joining me again.
My absolute pleasure. Great to be here. And yeah, I'm hoping we can sort of provide a holistic snapshot of this sort of, you called it spiritual seeking, but you know, true seeking is another great way of discussing it. But what's going on in the independent media? What's going on in this search of gnosis, this journey of gnosis that we're all sort of going through in this collective amnesia age we call, you know, living as a human at the start of the 21st century. So yeah, let's do it. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, you know, even what you said right there is kind of interesting, because on one level, I totally agree with you about the truth seeking and the spiritual seeking and those really being one. That's certainly if not my orientation, which I was about to say, my conclusion is that if you're seeking the truth, you will ultimately find yourself on a spiritual path. Although I guess I could have probably short-circuited about 5 to 7 years of my podcast and my journey just by listening to some of the great spiritual masters who've said that all along. But some of us have to learn, I guess, the hard way. So
and what's your definition of spirituality then? So as you were going through your podcasting journey, what sort of information sort of helped you to understand some sort of spiritual essence of life, and how would you define it? And then I'll have a crack afterwards.
Yeah, because as we were just talking about, I mean, we share some similarities there, but we also share some differences, which I think are really cool. Because I like your straight ahead approach. You seem like a very down to earth guy. You know, people talk to you, they feel like they're getting kind of the authentic version of Phil, which is, I think, terrific. And for me, I mean, my authenticity comes from really pretty much being a normal, everyday kind of guy who is looking for success, money, the normal things in life. You know, going to college, get a good job, get my own business, make money, do that kind of stuff. And I did that, and I was good at it to a certain extent. I had a lot of failures, but eventually it came out well for me. But inside of that, I always had the idea in the back of my head that while I'm doing this, I'm also thinking about the big picture questions of who am I really, and why am I here really? And the thing for me, which I guess was surprising when I started podcasting, is I thought, okay, I've kind of lived this kind of dual thing, but everyone's doing it, right? I mean, ultimately, if they could, everyone would be asking those questions. And when I got to that point and started spending full time asking those questions. And my approach was just to approach the people who were ordained with being the knowledge holders, the scientists, the experts. I found that no, they're not really interested in truth seeking in the way that we're talking about it, or spiritual seeking in the way that we're talking about it. They're kind of stuck in a different thing. And because I know you through, I met you through Gordon White and some of the interviews you did there, and I've listened to some of your other interviews, you have a somewhat similar but also very different path that you've taken that I think people will find really interesting in terms of what that spiritual seeking is for you.
Yeah, the cognitive dissonance and the rejection suppression of information that could revolutionize different minds and hearts, particularly in academia and the scientific world, is very real. Look at history. You know, the fringe is always sort of the next step in the evolution of consciousness. And it goes without saying that there's a lot of people in that field who have a lot of there's a lot resting on their continuation or perpetuation of sort of a materialist viewpoint, especially.
Let me jump in there for 1 second, because I agree with that, but I also think that, you know, just like there's a difference between my story and your story, there's also just a different kind of orientation that people start with that require that they go down one path. I mean,
I came from a materialist perspective when I first started.
But you had some experiences that kind of pulled you in another direction, right?
Well, I think we all have those experiences, Alex. I think we either attune to the connection that we have with our reality or we don't. We reject it and suppress it or we don't. And so I just paid attention. My experience with understanding some sort of spirituality in my life, which I simply define as basically exploring, understanding, and expanding my experience of connection with life. That's my basic definition of spirituality. How am I connected? In what ways? What's going on internally through all my internal layers? And how does that connect to the outside world?
Give folks a sense, and I think I've heard this before, but some of the earliest experiences you remember of having that kind of knock on the door kind of awareness that then you said you connected to, what was that? What were they? Were they connected with psychedelics? Were they connected with paranormal experiences? I mean, alien encounters? How did it come for you?
Well, paranormal and other independent intelligence experiences came later. When I was about 12, I asked the question, all right, the universe is expanding, but what is it actually expanding into? That metaphysical question really got that sort of that energy spinning within me. I'm like, okay, I've got some questions now. That's where is this bloody universe that we call the universe? So that spatial question sort of catalyzed an ongoing search for the truth. And as my life unfolded, I realized that there was these sort of weird coincidences, which some people call synchronicities, but there seems to be this meaningful connection on some level. And I was very skeptical at the start, even though there was some really big stuff happening.
Like what?
Especially.
Like what? Give us an example. And also, you know, just to kind of drill into this a little bit more. If I was 12 years old, and I was 12 years old, and I had like maybe thoughts like that, maybe not as profound as that, but I would just go and ask my dad, or ask somebody else, or ask a teacher as a last resort,
yeah,
and I'd be done with it. So why wasn't that enough for you? What was, there's something unique there that drove you in a different direction.
Well, look, I was a little rebel from way back when. You know, I had a lot of excess energy. I wasn't okay with authoritarian figures, parents, teachers, etc. So I was rebelling in my own way. So I didn't really have somebody that I could look up to and have a good amount of respect for to ask these sorts of questions. So very early on in my childhood and early adulthood, I began to take serious that I needed to answer these questions for myself, because I was seeing basically lies and deception and hypocrisy all around me. So I was like, well, what's happening around me isn't a satisfactory a place to search for these answers. So I've got to look within. So I did that. There's many ways it pops up. There's an infinite amount of ways that you can pop up. A lot of it had to do with symbolism. So I had a lot of connections to particular animals and numbers and people and concepts. It's really informational packages that I really started to connect with. But not
Can you
only
give us
that.
an example? Give me an example that I can really understand where your experience was probably different than your peers or anyone else you knew, and you were trying to process it. An experience with a number or an animal or something like that at an early age. That'd be interesting. I'd like to hear the thought on that.
Well, look, one of the first animals I connected with was the bat. It was because I was very deeply in depression when I was younger. The shadow side really came to my forefront very, very early. And so I just had this odd connection with bats that would appear to me at certain times, that would swoop me, all this sort of crazy stuff. You can cite an example, but that's really not going to be satisfactory.
It's satisfactory to me. How old were you when you started just seeing, having a lot of encounters with bats and that kind of thing?
Well, that would have been around 17, 18, something like that. And so, but what I did, Alex, is I was a skeptic and I wanted to rationalize this. So I looked at all these experiences happening that I'm going, okay, well, the chance of that, for example, happening is a million to one. And then something else happened that's directly related to that. And I was like, okay, well, the chance of that happening is like a billion to one. I was just sort of making these figures up in my head, but I was sort of trying to calculate if it was just random chance or if there was some connection. And as these connections, these meaningful synchronicities, or these experiences kept on happening that indicated that I was connected. I got to the point where I was like, well, that's now infinity to one. Basically, chance is ruled out. There is some basic connection. Now, of course, through that process, there's the trickster energy, the shadow stuff. You get a little bit sidetracked with certain things. It gets very confusing. But most certainly, there is a lens that you can look through on life. That starts with the basic premise of you are connected. So that's basically the transition going from materialism to some sort of idealism or animism or whatever it may be for each individual. But essentially, we've got to train the ego to not just understand I as it's understood etymologically, but it needs to understand we. So as we start to connect with our reality and become conscious of those connections, not only are we more capable of seeing it because we're developing a conceptual framework, an apparatus that actually can interpret the experience more aligned to that connection. But we're also creating that connection, that co-creation process, more so because we're sending out electromagnetic vibrations. We're having this informational exchange with our reality in a way that actually brings that connection even further to the forefront. So I believe that we all have these sorts of experiences. Some of which are very obvious at times to people. Some of them are very subtle. A lot of people reject it and pretend it's not happening and just label it as a coincidence. And a lot of people understand the connection. And so
But
essentially,
hold
the
on,
best.
hold on one second, Phil, because here's where I guess it gets interesting on a couple of different levels. One is, you said a bunch of stuff that I agree with, and then you said some stuff I'm not so sure of. And at the
All
same
right, let's
time,
talk about that.
yeah. So when you say, the electromagnetic connection, I just interviewed Dr. Dean Radin, and I know that you've interviewed Dr. Dean Radin on your show. And Radin's path is kind of interesting because it's kind of crossing your path. You're into magic kind of more than I am. I'm kind of a little bit leery of the spiritual architecture it presupposes and whether we really established that. But Radin's kind of jumping over and saying, yeah, I want to explore that and stuff like that. But at the same time, he'll tell you in their lab, they've tested for the electromagnetic connection associated with psi slash paranormal slash magic as they've studied it. And he says, no, they can't find any trace of it. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not there, but don't we have to kind of take seriously the best we have? And that's what Radin is in terms of researching this when he says, well, guys, with our tools, if we're going to look at it in that way that you're talking about there, Phil, we've done it. I've done it. It doesn't show up. I've built the Faraday cage. I've done all the stuff and it doesn't show up. What do you make of that?
Well, what I would say is just point to the evidence from, say, the HeartMath Institute that there is an electromagnetic field that goes well beyond the physical body, coming from the heart as well as the brain. There's all layers of the electromagnetism. So regardless if they're able to capture that in a lab in terms of how that interacts with other fields, and you can also look at it morphogenic as well, such as Sheldrake's work. That's another layer of fields that.
But hold on, because again, I want to parse this. I want to parse this kind of carefully. Anything more you have to say on the heart math folks and the that stuff? I'd love to hear, because that's an interview that's in my queue that hasn't happened. The research there is solid, and it's, we don't know what it means, but it's solid and it's extremely, extremely compelling kind of stuff. Switch over to Sheldrake, and I agree with you, but Sheldrake isn't measuring fields in that way. He's hypothesizing that the way this might work is some kind of field, but again, he's measured for the kind of fields that we know of, and they don't exist. But you're right. But again, we don't really know what Sheldrake's saying either, because we don't know what all these guys are saying, because there is this backdoor materialism of it too. So before I get too far going, let's talk more about the heart stuff. Have you done any interviews on that, or what has your research told you? Where do you think that research leads us? And then let's talk about Sheldrake.
Oh, look, it's a really good field. Now, I haven't delved into it in an actual podcast, and that's certainly something that I would like to do.
Maybe we'll do one together.
Yeah, sure. It'd be awesome to sort of get down to, you know, sort of where they are, what the clarity is that their research has shown. And look, one of the biggest things that I love about the research into the heart is the neurology that's been found in it. So there's 40,000 nerve cells or neurons within the heart. There's 100 billion in the cerebral brain, 100 million in the digestive system. The cerebral and digestive system used to be connected in the fetus. So it was originally one brain, and then it disconnected at some point and was still connected via the nervous system, obviously. But there's all this independent analysis going on in our body, and including on a cellular level as well, and the way that this, you know, this quantum biology and the instantaneous sharing and communication throughout the body. But there are some primary areas of analysis and essentially determining a response to environmental stimuli. And the heart is the first thing that responds to our environmental stimuli. So there's the information that is generating from our heart, and then it combines with whatever's coming from the gut brain, the second brain, as well as the cerebral brain. And suddenly they all combine together and give us our conscious awareness, our egoic snapshot, our finite snapshot of infinite consciousness, as I like to describe it. So, but the heart is a very powerful tool that we, if we listen and or learn to listen better, that we can sort of learn this sort of information that it's trying to tell us.
And isn't it interesting? It's always just remarkable when these findings, revolutionary new science findings, map perfectly with wisdom that's been passed down forever, and also just stuff that we experience. I mean, you go talk to your grandmother and she'll talk about, I mean, most grandmothers will, about the heart and feeling the heart and opening it, all this very kind of active verbiage, language that connects completely to what the new revolutionary research is saying. And just from a longer term kind of passed down wisdom, the symbology of with the heart, it just maps perfectly with this. So it's always amazing when we have these, you know, it's again a myth of progress kind of thing. Oh, here's our new discovery. Oh yeah, they've known that for thousands of years kind of thing.
Yeah, it's great. There is a better alignment from in scientific sort of investigation with some of the ancient or traditional disciplines, particularly spiritual. And that's fantastic. And there's so much for science to evolve through as well. A particular approach right now, the empirical approach, could potentially be evolved to incorporate the inner world. So how do we sort of quantify and qualify more internally as well? We're very much at the beginning, and obviously...
I got to jump in there. I told you I was going to skeptico you a million times. Sure. So I'm going to jump in there. Again, this gets to this topic that I kind of just touch on sometimes, and it might be fun to stretch it out into a little bit longer discussion. And that's the phrase I always put on it, is backdoor materialism, you know? So it's like we're out there preaching post-materialism. Hey, materialism doesn't work, and consciousness is the underlying fundamental nature of everything, and everything arises out of consciousness. And then as soon as we get any kind of momentum, we want to go back and go, and here's how we can measure it, control it, you know, make it better, optimize it. You know, it's like, wait a minute. Well, in what way would that mean anything to use empirical means to, you know, study the efficacy of, I mean, there's an underlying contradiction there that suggests, that begins with the assumption that driving this back into the material world and measuring it in some way is somehow good, useful, important for some goal that we have ill-defined and we really think we've moved past. I mean, do you get where I'm at all coming from with the backdoor materialism?
Yeah, but I would say that the material world isn't the material world. It's an expression of reality. And when we look at our scientific investigation into that expression of reality, if we look through a different lens, we're going to see it differently. We're going to have different results. But we shouldn't be looking at it as, well, science is only the study of matter. Science isn't the study of matter. Science is the organic investigation of humanity into reality. And so how that unfolds, how we measure and actually interact with the so-called material world, which is very much connected to the quantum physical world, it's connected to the observer and how that and the collapse of the wave function into a particle experience, all the way the co-creative process happens, as well as things that we don't sort of know about. So I would suggest that science is perfectly doing, you know, what it's meant to be doing, is investigating.
I hear you, and I'm going to bring you back to a point where we were at in our prior discussion that, to me, gets at this question in a beautiful way. And I was telling you about my story with my friend and excellent host of the terrific show, Boot at the Gas Pump, that I always reference because it's an incredible show with so many incredibly spiritually awakening people, as Rick calls them. And one of them is Amma, known as the Hugging Saint. You know, and I love this story about Amma because, in a way, I think it combines what you're saying with what I'm saying, but in a way, it leaves a big gap. So Amma is this person who definitely, from all appearances, for millions of people, seems like an awakened or an awakening soul with incredible spiritual presence, whatever that means to doubters or whatever, I don't know, just you go check her out. I checked her out. I went to a weekend with her in LA. I didn't have an incredible spiritual experience, but a lot of other people did, and that's means something. Not everyone, I think, is intended to have the same experience at the same time. But the story that about Amma that I love is Amma is tireless in her work. You just go see her, and however old she is, I don't know how her physical body withstands the work that she does. And on the last day, she stays up for like 36 hours, constantly hugging people, helping people, doing all this stuff. And when she's in India, if you watch the videos, it's even more impressive. She's out there digging latrines with the untouchables and all this stuff. And one of her disciples went up to her one day and said, Amma, you're always talking about how the world doesn't exist and we're spiritual beings and none of this stuff matters, and yet you're doing all this stuff for the world. And her response is what I've written there on the page. She says, world? What world? As if she's the embodiment of that kind of Vedantic, yogic, kind of beautiful contradiction of someone who realizes that, you know, just because you're in service doesn't mean you're attached at all to any of the service. You're just this soul being who's kind of going through life. That is that paradox, that catch-22 world, what world contradiction, to me explains the backdoor materialism. But Dean Radin doesn't. Using new empirical means to find out, you know, how magic really works, that doesn't ring true to me in a way that Amma does. Phil, I throw it to you, buddy. What do you say?
Yeah, well, it's a divine economy. Life is full of divine economies, isn't it? That's the many truths theory that I talk about. It's one sort of big paradox in many, many ways. For example, how can we have one thing, but also two things? So, this monistic view on life, there is only one thing, which is part of sort of the new age sort of appropriation stuff. But also, how does duality work with that? And I just look at it as simply as, okay, well, there's look at it as mass. You've got different numbers, which are individual numbers on the mathematical spectrum. The mathematical spectrum is the one thing. Each number is the two. So zero and one, there's your first step duality. And then it continues. So, but look, I appreciate Alma and her choice in terms of how she wants to provide that capital S service. That's fantastic. I learned a long time ago to provide that uppercase S service to myself, first and foremost, that spiritual service, like really genuinely. Look at what it means to be an authentic person and care for myself, go through the self-healing, go through whatever sort of magic of life you can experience. We're only living this life once, Alex, so we may as well have a crack at it and really enjoy it, but really live it, facilitate the best sort of experience of well-being, of good experience that we possibly can. But I would suggest, especially to myself, but also others, that we need to have some sort of balance. Okay, fine. She wants to decide that there is no world. I would sort of disagree with that. I would say there is a world. Okay, it might be deceptive in terms of the fundamental nature of reality, but we're literally here having this dualistic experience. The way I describe that is there's some people, the spiritual community essentially says that consciousness or mind or spirit is at the core of reality, and then the material world is some sort of illusion. And I would suggest that, okay, it's deceptive and it's not necessarily a pure expression of what reality is, but it's still an experience we're having. And so if you want to spend your life only giving to others and not really to yourself, or giving to others is an expression of giving to self as well anyway, so there's a great argument there. But I like to experience my life. I'm not going to invest all of my service in the outside world. I'm going to do it for myself, including having some fun. Really live my life to the best, best of my ability. Work out all these layers, which is a big part of what I've been sort of sharing with my audience, is really connecting with the various layers of health, including things like creativity and expressing that creativity and going on adventures and whatever. Face your fears, jump out of a plane, doesn't sort of matter. So that's her choice around how she wants to conceptualize life. She conceptualizes as what world? Well, okay, sure. On one level, I believe that is actually true. But on another level, I'm literally having an experience right now in this so-called illusory world, and I may as well enjoy it. It's a very, very real experience, regardless if it's not a very, very real reflection of true reality.
I really like where we're going with this discussion because it's a discussion that I rarely have a chance to have on Skeptico. And I like that the way it's kind of flowing is really consistent with the two things you brought up at the beginning is spirituality and truth. And I think what you're talking about is kind of a cool way of putting it. I like that you just kind of push back and the way you're pushing back makes sense, and I think will make sense to a lot of people. But along those lines, I want to take it one step further because there's another clip that I want to play for you that is kind of provocative, but is highly meaningful to me, and I want to reintroduce it and see if we can talk on this for a while. So next up for consideration, Phil, is another BatGap guest, a guy that I'm sure slipped under the radar for 90% of the people who listen to BatGap. But it's a guy who said something that just has stuck with me and has been so meaningful to me. It's in my list of daily questions that I ask and challenge myself with to kind of propel me forward. The guy's name is Norio Kushi. He's a Japanese truck driver. He's American, but Japanese by ancestry. And he's a truck driver, really is a truck driver. And his experience, and you got to give Rick Archer again a ton of credit because, true to the name of the show, Buddha at the Gas Pump su suggests that Buddha may be right there, filling up with diesel the truck stop. This guy claims he never was into meditation, never was into, you know, deep kind of spiritual devotion of any kind or another, but was contemplating these deep questions on the road and thinking very deeply about them. And the one thing that he said, which I just think is a golden, golden nugget, I'm going to play for you and then we can talk about it.
The words came, appeared, that said, life is not going to turn out.
And I'm going to stop it right there in order to keep it beautifully succinct. And I want to expound on it a little bit because it's one of those things that I think is so great in the truth-seeking path that we're talking about, in the spiritual-seeking path, that someone can say one little throwaway line like that, and it can reach into my soul and touch me. And it doesn't reach into everybody's soul, but it reaches into my soul. And it says, you know, I'm a doer. I make things happen, and I'm successful, and I have a good family and a wife and all this stuff, and I made it happen. And you know what? It's not going to work out. It never works out. Something is always looming that isn't going to work out. And it truly, from the deeper I get into my spirituality, the deeper I understand the fundamental truth in that, that I want to control things. I want to scheme. I want to, even if it's good scheming, I want, you know, to scheme on the behalf of my kids or on behalf of this group or that group. And in the end, none of the scheming ever works out, because that's not what service is about. That's not what I'm a what world is about. She's saying the same thing. She's saying, I'm just doing this crazy shit because I'm doing it, not because I think it's going to work out. It's just what I am drawn to do at the moment. Okay, mate, I toss it over to you.
That sounded like an attempt at an Aussie accent at mate as well.
Well, you know, I got halfway into it, and then I said, I'll stick with the Chicago, but I'll use the mate. Hey, you know, all us Americans, we love when someone calls us mate. It's like the greatest thing in the world, you know?
It's a very endearing term. But yeah, look, life doesn't work out as we expect, sure, because we've got wants that don't align with needs. That's the way I sort of conceptualize it very early on. I was going, okay, I've got these desires, but my desires aren't coming to fruition a lot of the time. A lot of the time they do. I think we are very powerful co-creators in our reality. Our potential to manifest, the potential we have as manifestors in our experience is very, very strong. How I learned to figure it out myself is that because the subconscious activity, the subconscious is one of the most powerful manifestors, more so than the egoic mind at least, then I need to connect with what's going on subconsciously to really amplify my manifest potential, so to speak. That also goes to the blueprint, etc. as well, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But essentially, some things do work out, and it's great. We achieve goals, whatever it may be. Sometimes we don't. There's this inner sort of conflict that we all are sort of experiencing, where we're trying to achieve whatever it may be, whatever goals and whatnot, and again, it doesn't turn out sometimes. So I guess what I'm saying is that, well, I'd like to start off with that answer in terms of something you said before. You said awakening instead of awaken. And I think it's really integral that as a seeker of truth, you know, undertaking this process of trying to work out what the hell's going on, is that we really embed into us that it's a journey. We need to ask the questions to ourselves seriously. Do we accept when we're wrong? What is our capacity to actually accept within us when we've been wrong about something? Do we apply cognitive dissonance? Or are we open enough to receive new information in a way to revolutionize our belief systems, or, you know, just certain beliefs within them? The other question is, do we really accept when we don't know? So that's a very, very important question that we need to embrace within ourselves. Do we fill gaps, even on an unconscious or subconscious level, that we're not really aware of? Or are we facing ourselves, face thyself, in a way where we're genuine in terms of we're wrong about something and we seriously don't know the answer to it? So this is a journey of waking up, not, all right, we've reached a plateau, I'm now conscious, I'm now awakened or enlightened or empowered or whatever that some people like to get to. I prefer personally because, you know, I get bored pretty quickly. So if I've got to deal with myself the way I am right now for the rest of my life, I'm going to be pretty disappointed. I need to revolutionize and have rebirths in my life and continue on this journey. So that's a really good starting point in terms of connecting with the process that we're actually going through. Now, through that process, we want to try and create stuff. We want to have desires met. We want to ensure that our expectations come into manifestation to a certain degree. I realized quite early on my journey, that I had these wants, these desires that weren't connected to my needs. So what I did is I undertook a process of trying to align my needs with my wants. So how do you work out what your needs are? You pay attention to experience. The way I like to describe this, Alex, is one of the most powerful manifestors in my life was not my subconscious and not my ego. It was something else. Whatever created me in this particular time and space with these parents, with these genetics, with these epigenetic experiences, with these early stuff that sort of influenced how I was programmed into reality, that blueprint, which some people call the soul, other people might just call it growth potential. There's many ways of describing whatever this thing is right at the very fundamental layer of us. And then there's also that interconnects with the whole co-creative collective type consciousness sort of grid, energy grid that we've got going on as well. But I've started to pay attention to that because it was helping me. I just saw this guidance in my life that I went, okay, well, I didn't create that. That was definitely not subconscious because it's not part of my apparatus at that point. So what I need to do is connect with this blueprint. And this blueprint was showing me my needs, essentially. And the way I describe it is just my needs are my realizing my growth potential. So in other words, what that means is connecting with the next phase of the expansion of your experience of consciousness. So that's what I took seriously. I just went, okay, well, I know this blueprint, which can be very tricky at times. It can be very hard to discern whether or not that's that or it's something else. But I did accept and respect its existence and started trying to align with it. And so through that process, I realized that, all right, so it's got some needs, but those needs can be met in an infinite amount of ways. They don't have to happen in this time and space with this particular person having this particular experience. Your needs can be met, your growth potential can be met in myriad ways. So therefore, there's the other aspect of the called free will that can freely choose how to have your needs met. So I just went, okay, well, put down what you think you want. It's okay to have your desires filled, let that roll to the best of your ability. But if they don't come to fruition, if they are out of alignment with whatever these fundamental needs are, then that's cool. So I detached pretty early from actually having to achieve this with this particular time and all the rest of it. That gave me a level of freedom that I'd never actually had before. Now, in saying that, it's also awesome to want to actually create your reality, to create whatever you want. And so it's this balance between trying to come into sort of alignment with your needs. There is situations where your needs do not contradict with whatever your desires might be. So to have, I don't know, a garden out the back with the particular arrangements of vegetables and fruits or whatever, that might not necessarily align fundamental to the absolute needs that we have. So we've got the power to sort of create within that framework, within those boundaries. And I'd love to talk a little bit about boundaries in a bit. But yeah, it's one of those things where, are you true to your needs? Can you align your wants to your needs? Are you going to be disappointed? Is there suffering? Is there a lack of realization of expectations? Yes. Well, are you going to cry about it? Is it going to be something that causes you essentially abuse yourself over? So do you inflict self-abuse, self-harm over the fact that your desires aren't being met? There's a whole process of dealing with this mystery, because really this is what it is. I'm talking about truth earlier. If we're not getting to a point where if we get to a point where we think we know the absolute truth, we probably need to go down to the bottom of the mountain and start again, because this whole experience is a journey of connecting with the truth. Now, it's awesome that we get some really big convictions, or sort of get some bigger frameworks in life. Do we absolutely cement and solidify ourselves into those belief systems, or are we open to that evolving and refining in whatever particular way? So yeah, look, I appreciate that we don't get our needs, our wants all the time. We can do it at certain times, and enjoy the mystery, enjoy the journey, Alex.
You know, Phil, I was going to take it in one direction, but now I'm going to take it in an entirely different direction. Because I got to say, some of that new age bullshit, it just drives me nuts. From the new age people and from the magic people. I mean, I've manifested unbelievable shit in my life in terms of wealth, in terms of relationships, and in terms of all that. And I didn't deal with no magic. I didn't deal with no new age pyramids or any of that. I did it the old fashioned way. I went out and read all the success people that I could find and all the self-help people. And you can call them magical people because all the magic community wants to go, oh, Tony Robbins. I went with Tony Robbins and walked down the fires and I went and read Stephen Covey and all that. But they're not approaching it from a magic standpoint. They're approaching it from you have an alignment problem between your beliefs, your goals, and your actions. And here's how you need to make that stuff happen in order to manifest it. There's nothing new age-ish about it. There's nothing magical about it. And guys like this, guys like Bill Gates, guys like Warren Buffett, who then the conspiratorial, and I'm can be very conspiratorial, but like I said on Greg Carlwood's last show when I interviewed him and I went off on this rant that probably no one got. It's like Bill Gates. Go read about Bill Gates. Yes, he was a rich kid. Yes, he was privileged. Yes, his dad gave him a huge leg up in terms of connections. But it was by chance that he became the second richest guy in the world. It was a very strange circumstances. He would have been worth $100 million no matter how you cut it because he was brilliant and he hit the right thing at the right time. But it wasn't anything else. It wasn't anything magical. Warren Buffett, for God's sakes, you can go see every damn transaction he's made. It's all in the public record. There can't be anything magical or conspiratorial or secret society about a guy who eats at McDonald's every day, even though he's worth billions of dollars. People have a fundamental confusion about this. If you want those things, the way to do them is not through new age-ish stuff, not through magical practices. Just go down to the bookstore and follow the masters. The masters are the guys who already have all the shit that you want. Go and do that, whether it's money or relationships. But most people, especially guys, you want money. So, you know, go make that happen and then come around later and you can talk all the rest of this stuff. But don't confuse this, you know, the conglomeration of these different ideas. Manifesting stuff is different than this spiritual path. Well, let me stop before I go into too much of a tirade. Continued, I laid a lot on the table. Tell me what you think about that.
Yeah, you did lay a lot on the table. So there's a lot to unpack. I agree with you. Some of the new age has been sort of like this fundamentalist individualism, where this solipsist point of view sort of has creeped into the new age. I've got a lot of, I've written extensively about some of the problems with new age thought and belief and practice. But look, new age is a really big spectrum of practice. It's not just chaos magic. It's not just you know, sort of the incorporation of the Gnostic path into contemporary sort of a contemporary approach. There's also the appropriation of all these different religions and the cross-pollination of all these religions and spiritual practices. So the New Age is quite a large area. It's
But
essentially.
hold on. Let me jump in there. What I'm saying, I want to be really precise. I'm saying that I see no evidence, personal evidence, that it's efficacious in the way that is suggested. And it's clear to me, clear as anything, that what's much more effective for manifesting the kind of things that people say they want, like money, it's much more effective just to follow the people that have already figured that out. I don't know why people go down the chaos magic route in order to get a new apartment. It just seems kind of ridiculous to me, or even a relationship. It's just, what are you doing? There's a lot easier, more effective way to do it. I'm not even sure that the chaos magic thing is effective, but I know it's less effective than this other one because I can see all the people. You go to one of those seminars and you see all these people who are millionaires that weren't millionaires before. They're manifesting in a very specific way.
Yeah, look, I agree. Look, to a certain extent, I was going to answer the question. I just wanted to frame it within the new age stuff. There's a lot of goodness that has come out of new age, and there's not so much goodness, which I've tried to focus on in my writing, was the point I was trying to make. Now, in terms of magic, it depends on your definition, Alex. My definition is simply the intention process. So you putting in intentions to create something, that is magic, because there is an energetic exchange with our environment. Let me finish before you butt in. It's really important. You can look at our connection with the environment as simply ecological. You can look at, for example, bees and ants that act like a colony. Humans are actually work like that on that material ecological level as well. So there is an innate inner connection with our environment, including on the planet itself, even if you just look at it through the material lens. Then you can look at it through other top field stuff, the whatever informational exchange, you can look at energetic exchange, you can look at experience, whatever. There's all these different layers of inner connection, right? So that we can at least establish that, even just looking at the entanglement with quantum physics, right? So what that means is that the way that we design our minds, the way that we put intentions out into the world and intentions into our body and translate those intentions into behaviors, that is a magical process, because what you're doing is you're increasing the likelihood of a problem, what you want to come into manifestation. So our mutual buddy, Gordon White, he describes it as increasing probability. So his chaos magic approach is increasing probability to achieve his particular goals. Now, we can do that. There's no specific way that we have to literally try and create our reality. You can do it through whatever those self-help mechanisms, by actual particular discipline practice and networking and whatever it is. There's many ways that we can try and create a reality. Sure, that might be a little bit airy for somebody like you to think about chaos magic. That's up to each individual to determine what works for them and if it's important, if it works.
No, you're not understanding my point. It's not that it's airy. I mean, I come around to chaos magic now and I understand it. I just don't think it's effective for anything that I want in my life. And again, I come back and I'll push on this. I don't think I don't see any evidence that it's effective in general in the way people
think. Have you tried
it? No. No, well, yeah, of course. I've tried it in the sense that we're all, I pick and choose. I love Gordon's work and I really respect him, but I don't go down. I only agree with about 40% of anybody, at the most. So Gordon's great. He's 40%.
I
He's
only
top.
Agree with about 40% of myself, Alex.
So. Exactly. So the reality, the truth of what Gordon points out is that, hey, we're all practicing magic, right? All the time, right? So yeah. I'm talking
and that's
to
my point too.
Well, but you're kind of stretching that point when you say intentionality and all the rest of this, because I'm telling you, Tony Robbins, for example, he isn't teaching intentionality. He's teaching a very specific set of how to reorient your thinking in a particular way in order to make you more effective. If you go read Stephen Covey, who's now passed away, who spiritually was a Mormon and was kind of a strange guy in all the way that Mormons are, but was brilliant in terms of time management, in terms of work management. These people were geniuses. And there's many, many, I mean, I read over 200 business self-help books. Go turn on, CNBC and watch Shark Tank, which I can't even watch it. I get so annoyed wanting to throw stuff at the TV. But the essential nature, these people are multimillionaires for a reason. The way they orient themselves to the world, to their problems, to the problem of amassing wealth, is nothing to do with chaos magic. And they're infinitely more effective than the anything I've heard about from the chaos magic community. It's just, it's not even a reasonable conversation to have. So if you want to do chaos magic and think that you're adjusting the odds from 50-50 to 49-51, have at it. But if you want to amass some wealth, just go read from the people who've done it and are going to tell you how to do it. It's a much more effective way.
as I said, I think we've got our own way of practicing this. I think there are intentions are at the basis of Tony Robbins stuff because it's about goal setting. And I absolutely agree that the
you don't know the you don't know the material. You don't know the material. You haven't gone through it, right?
There's well, to a certain extent, I have, but not a large extent. But surely part of the primary sort of agenda is to set goals. Is that correct? And setting goals is setting an intention. It is.
You're
right?
Kind of you're kind of playing very fast and loose with, you know, I mean, let's not even get into the whole Tony Robbins thing, but he started with neuro-linguistic programming, the Bandler and Grinder, who were psychologists, who were working with schizophrenic patients, and he was learning how to communicate with them. But he's incorporated a million different things into it because you know what Tony Robbins does, which is brilliant and keeps it fresh, is he says very simply that what he does is when he wants to master something, he goes and finds someone who's mastered it and he asks them what they believe about their mastery of it. And that's the genius move there. It's not how do you do it, because if you go ask somebody how do you ride a bike and they're an expert bike rider, they can't tell you. But if you go ask them, hey, how do you master that corner? They're liable to tell you something about how they believe, how they feel, what their inner workings are. And that's what you need to get at. But, you know, again, I've read literally, I was reading everything I could get my hands on in terms of, you know, how to, back in the day, you know, how to print a business card, what it should say on the front, on the back, how to present it, how to do. So there's, you know, there's a lot of stuff there. It's not just goal setting. No, it's well, there's a whole technology.
Let me jump in. Look, when you move from a materialist, separateness, biological, meaningless universe perspective into some sort of mindful, you know, we're connected perspective, you need to look through a different lens. The way that you interpret and process your environment and your experience needs to be done in a way where the fundamental belief is connection, right? And so that's a shift from I to we in the ego. It's about reprogramming the mind. I will quickly get into that reprogramming of the subconscious in a quick moment. But the point being is that how that manifests for people, how they choose to experience and have ritual and routine and all the rest of it through that so-called connective lens or interconnective lens is up to each individual. So, all right, so maybe some of the most wealthiest and successful people in the world like that aren't necessarily, you know, practicing something like chaos magic, but they, you know, that doesn't mean that they're in a complete coherence with their environment. Just, I mean, have a look at what happens when people get wealth and fame. It doesn't necessarily turn out that great a lot of the time. So just because they've got that doesn't necessarily mean they're, you know, a coherent, authentic being. Someone like Tony Robbins absolutely might. And I 100% agree. So there are practices that people choose to do. That's their individual choice. It may work to a certain extent. Maybe it does increase probability sometimes, maybe not other times. It depends if it actually aligns to the needs and the blueprint that I actually talked about before. I 100% believe through my own experience that my blueprint has been the primary driver of my manifest potential, growth potential. So therefore, I want to align to that. Now, what you're talking about is the rearrangement, the NLP, the rearrangement of the egoic mind and the subconscious mind. I 100% agree with. Because I got to a point when I was in my, you know, sort of early adulthood where I was like, okay, I've got this egoic perspective of connection, of we, not just I, but we as well. But I'm really depressed and I've got all this subconscious trauma and all this stuff that's poor programming that is getting in the way of me enjoying my life to, you know, to the level I could. And not only that, it's undermining what I'm trying to achieve with my egoic conscious free will mind. And so what I had to do is go through a lot of meditation, a lot of deep meditation, a lot of mindfulness in general in life, a lot of facing the shadow, facing thyself, really understanding my contradictions and hypocrisies and trying to rearrange, reprogram, redesign my subconscious, which our subconscious is only subconscious in each particular moment. Like, for example, if I use the word now, right now, that is my subconscious coming into light. So that it's always in the shadow of the subconscious, but it's not always, sorry, it's sometimes in the shadow, but it's not always in the shadow. So how you actually learn to understand what your subconscious is saying is how it manifests in your actual thoughts, your actual conscious experience, and then repeating, and then sort of in response to that, if it's not what something that you actually want. For example, if you're, you know, being driven by trauma a lot of your life and it causes anger and sadness and whatnot, whatever. So you might, what you want to do is actually recognize that within yourself and then go back into the subconscious and redesign it in another way, which is more conducive to health and happiness and well-being and all the rest of it. So I spent a huge amount of time doing that, trying to get my egoic mind and my subconscious mind into some sort of alignment. And that alignment wasn't just with each other, but also with this core blueprint stuff or this destiny stuff, whatever you want to call it. I know it sounds a bit new age, but it's been absolutely, without a doubt, a part of my experience. It was very, very clear to me earlier on that a lot of this experience that I was having wasn't being driven by myself. So what I try to do is try to align that egoic and subconscious mind to that sort of blueprint. All right, so sure, there's really good measures and ways in which we can manifest reality. That some people do it in different ways to others. You know, what is it? What is it? Like, it's all good and well to have achievement in life, Alex. This is another sort of lesson I learned a long time ago. Is that, yeah, cool, get a good job, have a good family, you know, achieve whatever goals, be at the top of your game, whatever field, discipline you may be in. They're good achievements. They're good successes. But that's, to me, that wasn't real success. Real success to me was coming into coherence with myself. So in terms of my internal layers of health, actually understanding myself, actually being real and raw to myself, and coming to some sort of equilibrium in my moment. So dealing with past traumas and all the bullshit from the past and sort of sorting all that out in some sort of ordered way. So it's going to be a good experience for me. It's actually going to help. It's designed in a way that actually manifests exactly what I sort of would prefer. Actually being a healthy and happy person. And so coming to that equilibrium in the moment and then dealing with each moment as it comes through in, again, that healthy and happy framework.
Phil, just like last time, we've talked for an hour and we haven't mentioned your book. So, I do want to, because like I told you, I enjoyed the book. I thought it was really kind of cool. A page turner, it drew me in. Like you, like the author of this book who admits he's not much into novels or sci-fi, but wrote a sci-fi novel and a damn good one, you know, as we're moving into wrapping this thing up. Tell people about this book, and I certainly hope they pick it up. I went and bought a copy, even though you sent me a copy, because I think we need to support this kind of work. It's a great book, and it's pretty cool. So tell people about what you tried to do here.
Well, I appreciate that, Alex. I'm really glad you enjoyed it. It's, as you mentioned, I'm not really into novels or sci-fi, or it's more of a thriller and a fantasy. It's a non-fiction fiction on many levels. It's very hard to label what this actual book is. I've tried to basically do a snapshot of what it means to be human at the start of the 21st century. So it's almost written as a history book, as in how sort of confusing our current moment is, and sort of what the general dialogue is, and the questions is truth seeking, all that sort of stuff. But I've just done it in a fun and engaging way, well, to the best of my ability. It's just the main character, Gary, he goes into a virtual reality game in the year 2020. And virtual reality has been evolved in terms of you step into something like a float tank and there's a frequency resonator. So it's like high frequency sound and magnetics, which basically attune the consciousness of the player to the software.
Don't tell them too much. They need to experience it.
That's in the first chapter. So it's just, this is the synopsis anyway. So he gets lost in this virtual reality game. So questions about the simulation theory, about the nature of reality in general, what this intelligence interaction that we have. There's all these different cultural lenses and individual lenses that people experience these allegedly independent intelligences, such as spirits, angels, demons, aliens, multidimensional beings, whatever. There's all these ways of experiencing something, some sort of metaphysical or non-physical intelligence outside of us, or the essence of life, essentially, or the essences of life, like plants and animals and beyond, even into this extra-dimensional realm. And so I discuss all that and try and design in a way that talks about the whole package of what you essentially do on your podcast, which is consciousness, what's going on in the experience of consciousness, what's going on with spirituality, what's going on in the conspiratorial world in terms of how the system actually operates and how we could potentially design it to be more aligned to the justice of our future and actually have a bit of honorability and intelligence for how we actually move forward. Yeah, look, but it's also just a story of love, lust, and life. So lots of swearing and lots of cheeky experiences. And as you mentioned, it is a bit of a page turner because I try to pack as much information as I could into it and keep people really engaged. So if you're interested, yeah, you can go check that out. Check that book out. I loved writing it. I don't know where it came from. I just sat down and started writing it. Wasn't a plan. Got it out in 3 weeks and then just did some re-editing over a couple of months, self-published. I'm definitely looking at remarketing it. I've designed a new cover for it that I want to put on it. So I'm open to talking to publishers and agents about that as well. But yeah, really proud, I guess, that I was able to put such a cheeky little piece together and share that with the world.
Yeah, you should be proud. You know, and as we were talking about at the beginning, you ought to fill people in on your plans because you've done some podcasting, you've done some pretty impressive interviews. Like we said, you know, you did Dean Radin, you did Rupert Sheldrick, you did Gordon White, you did Greg Braden and Greg Carlwood. You did a bunch of other people, but you're kind of heading in a different direction now with your partner. So tell us what you have coming up where people are going to cross your work.
We're repackaging the podcast. It's now going to be called Mad Magic. I've described our reality for many years as a magical mad experience. So this duality, this shadow and the light, the dark, all the rest of it. So we're just going to be talking about all the good stuff about what it means to be a human experiencing this mystery. We're going to be focusing a lot on self-healing. So in terms of what's going on in relationship with self, as well as the people around us, there's so much anxiety and depression. The existential crisis is everywhere, Alex. And so we want to help people with that sort of stuff, sort of face that existential crisis in a healthy way and actually, you know, build a little bit of meaning and purpose in their life. My partner hasn't been active yet within this sort of space, in this independent media space, but she's the best conversation I get in my life, so I can't wait to share that with others. She's a wise old soul. She gets a lot. I've learned a lot from her, not just in the love that I've been able to get through knowing her for 25 years. As I mentioned earlier, we were together for a little while, then we broke up for 10 years and we've been back together for 5 years, and we've built an amazing communication with each other, one of the most advanced communications between two people I've ever experienced or seen. So I love to be able to share that with you. We've got a really healthy, coherent relationship where we're not codependent, but we certainly share where we are with each other without going into, you know, we have our own secrets, so to speak. Who doesn't, you know, you don't need to share everything with everybody. But we are very real and raw with each other. We understand each other. So that'll come out through the podcast. So if anybody's interested in sort of what's going on in terms of just the general discussion just the whole spirituality, personal development and systemic sort of analysis. And not only that, I will still continue to do interviews as well. I'm going to have your good self on the podcast. I look forward to that. I'm going to give you a bit of a skeptical approach myself. And see if I hold my own when it comes to that. But yeah, I really look forward to continuing interviewing some really genuine-hearted men and women around our world who actually want to give back and try and create something a little bit more aligned to justice for our future. A big part of my original podcast, which was called Redesigning Society, was to focus on not just identifying the issues, Alex, but also what are some of the solutions that's going on as well. What are some of these grassroots movements that are actually creating that more of that honorability for our world? So Jeff Lawton is a great example. He's one of the icons of permaculture. That system we discussed at length. There was Helena Norberg Hodge talking about localizing economies and decentralization. If we ever want to sort of move into a better direction, we need to sort of have a decentralized approach to this increasing centralized totalitarian tyranny that's manifesting on this global scale. It's a bit of a crazy situation that's going on there. So yeah, decentralization and honoring sovereignty in the self and the community is a great way of doing so through these particular models, such as localizing economies and permaculture and biodynamics and all that sort of stuff. So I'm going to continue on that sort of path too, but make it more of a personal discussion with people and hopefully help people to step into their authenticity better, because there's a huge need for it. Once again, there's so much suffering in our world, Alex. It's out of sync. It's imbalanced. Sure, natural part of life is to suffer, is to have this deception and this internal conflict and external conflict and all that sort of stuff. But it's definitely been whacked right out of balance by a pretty toxic system that we live in, and people are really struggling to figure out, to create a little bit of order in themselves and rearrange their minds in more healthy, happy ways. So hopefully,
hold on, because I mean, you got 50,000 issues there on the table, but I'll just pick on one that kind of wraps a couple of them together. And we talked a little bit about this last time, but I do get a little bit frustrated when I hear you guys, whatever that means, when I hear you guys talk, and it's like, hold on, you want to do permaculture? That's awesome. Fantastic. Have at it. Have fun with it, whatever that means. But if you want to deal with environmental issues, there's only one that's on a global scale that has global impact. And looking into that one brings us to the heart of the economic problems as well. Because what's the one issue? Of course, it's climate change. And as you and I talked about, one doesn't have to look very far to see just the fakery of it, the scientific fakery, the conspiratorial fakery of it. Not that I don't acknowledge that their man-made toxins released into the atmosphere have an effect on climate. But just look at it. It's just built on bullshit. It's not real. They don't even factor the sun into their calculations. You and I know this and agree that the climate change thing is bullshit. But the people you're talking about, when you bring it up, they're willing to look past that, but they're going, yeah, but we got to protect our environment. We got to do this. They've bought into the bullshit. Until we can sort these things apart, which we never can, because it's, you want to talk about the conspiracy and the conspiratorial nature of the culture shapers. I mean, they're running a game on us. And what's at the front of that game is climate change. And that also ties into the economic thing. I mean, you think the economic divide between the rich and the poor is bad now. Wait until they get that carbon tax and that carbon credit thing tied to every part of your life, where they're metering your every aspect of your existence and factoring it into your carbon footprint. And they're then determining, I mean, we don't have to extrapolate too far and get too conspiratorial to know that that is the direction that they're heading, is ever more control, ever more lockdown, ever more bureaucratic stuff. So You can't mash all these things together, because ultimately they come down to policy decisions. They come down to political decisions. If you want to grow your garden, awesome. Love your garden, love your food, love the rest of it, but don't put it on par with some kind of solution for some kind of global crisis. It's crazy to think that that stacks up against what these guys are trying to pull off with Paris climate summit, climate change on a worldwide basis. It's sticks and stones against M16s. It just doesn't, AK-47s. It's just not real.
Yeah, look, fair enough. There's many people who say, look, don't vote. That's the way to solve issues. Other people say, do vote. That's the way to solve issues. Create permaculture. try and create it from a policy stance. I think we should all be taking all approaches to move forward in a more general direction that's going to be good for us, both on an individual and collective level. But you said many things. First, the single biggest issue isn't climate change. Climate change is very real. Yes, the sun literally impacts our climate. The global warming propaganda, I'm assuming that's what you're sort of talking about, but global warming was very real as well because it was connected to the sun cycle. And most certainly, all right, the pollution and whatnot is certainly having an impact on our planet. CO2 and its relation to temperature, well, there's a lot of debate around that, obviously. And it seems that CO2 comes after the temperature changes. But moving on from that, we are literally, the single biggest issue, Alex, isn't that, it's we are literally decimating our natural systems. Life biodiversity being impacted.
Agreed, but the single biggest issue to whom? The single biggest issue to whom? I agree with you. We're totally in agreement. But the single biggest issue to whom? That's why I say it does come down to policy. It does come, so you can say we should get out and we should march and we should vote, but you got to be realistic. I mean, you live in Australia. I live in the United States, obviously, but I live in California. In California, my vote doesn't count. California is a democratic state. It's always going to be democratic, largely leaning. It's always going to vote on those policies. It just doesn't matter what I think.
One of the things that I've focused on, and I've interviewed Robert David Steele, and an amazing man, an ex-CIA agent who's really put together an open source package in terms of how we revolutionize our system, including electoral reform. If Trump was genuine at all, he should hire him straight up, because he's an absolute legend on many levels. Doesn't have it all right, but I certainly believe there are some sort of approaches that we can take. Now, of course, we're forever, Alex, we have cooperated together to create change, usually on a local level. Now we've got a challenge on a planetary level, the human tribe. We're finally interconnected through this instantaneous sharing information, where this cross-fertilization of culture is building this new wave, which, you know, as we spoke about last time, we don't have to agree with everything, but this is where we're sort of going. Are we going to collectively, I don't know how it's going to be done, but if we're going to move into a better direction, we need to cooperate. And we certainly need to think about how we readjust our system. There's all these different people doing all these different things. I think we're sort of moving in a general direction, which is more transparency and more openness in terms of the information. The truth is coming to light. But obviously, it's very controlled. The truth is controlled. We're put in our echo chambers. There's the divide and conquer strategy on so many different levels that are impacting us, including in the independent media. It becomes very confusing. But that doesn't mean we don't have to do anything, Alex. I think we should give the service to self and give the service to the outside world in whatever way is relevant to us. I don't think there's one easy answer to it. We need to do this, this, and this. I think what we should all be doing, especially in the independent media, is solidifying our connection, our cooperation with each other based around individual sovereignty. Once you connect with your internal sovereignty, as well as how this exchange of energy, information, spirit happens with the outside world, you get to the point of understanding natural law, that attractive force, that engagement with the forces, and then you have to actually give back as well. So how you give back, that means giving to the outside world is literally giving to self, and giving to self is literally giving to the outside world. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't pull up boundaries and make sure that we're not being harmed. It's not all this rainbows and unicorn sort of situation going on, but we certainly need to have some sort of respect for that natural engagement that we have with our external world, as well as have respect for the cooperation. We would not be here in where we are today in this day and age without cooperation on some sort of level, as a primitive sort of tribe, or as a modern day civilization. So that's a natural part of our development, and we need to respect that. How we do that, I don't know. I mean, you posed some pretty good questions there.
Well, I like what you said there. I mean, and I think you hit on something that I kind of noted that I agree with. It's about starting point is individual sovereignty. And we can wrap this up just by tying it back to the first topics we talked about. I mean, whether it's truth seeking or whether it's spiritual seeking, I would totally agree with you, Phil. It's about coming from a place of internal individual sovereignty is the truth seeker, is the spiritual seeker. So that's awesome, man. I mean, this is what I wanted to do with this interview. Two guys, two podcasters, just chatting it up, talking about what's going on. And great. We'll see how round two goes on your show. You know, I don't think I do Skeptico that much. It's just I say that because that's what other people do. This is just me, man. So I'm happy to field any questions you have when I come on your show. I look forward to it, man. It'll be fun. But thanks for this time. Our guest again has been Philip J. Watt. One of the books that a book that he's written that you might want to check out is The Simulation, but you'll also want to check out his new podcast, and I'll have a link to that.
You can check out my website, pushingthetippingpoint.com, YouTube, and Facebook is Philip J. Watt. Podcast is now going to be called Mad Magic. Really look forward to getting that off the ground. The Simulation book you can get at the website, and really look forward to continuing on this crazy journey in the independent media, because what a ride it's been.
Thanks again to Philip J. Watt for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I guess I'd have to tee up from this interview is, once all the research is done, once Dean Radin brings all these magicians into his lab and sets up the experiments, how effective do you suspect chaos magic will be found to be? Is it effective? Is it off the charts? Is it going to manifest your rent money and your new car and all the other things that you want? Or is it going to be a 49 versus 50 pair lab, you know, the Princeton lab where they stared at that random number generator for millions and millions of times and the skeptic said, look, it doesn't work. And all the rest of us said, well, yeah, it worked. It just wasn't a very big effect size, but it certainly worked. So I'm kind of tipping my hand there in terms of how I think the results will look. But I'd love to get your thoughts, opinions on that topic or something else you might want to discuss. Just let me know. I always like to hear what's going on inside your head as you're driving along or working and listening to this stuff. It's so cool to hear people connect and say how they're listening to the show and what the show meant and what the whole Skeptico experience is for them. So let me know on that. I do have a number of shows coming up that I'm very excited to bring to you, and a couple of other projects I keep alluding to, but hey, we'll just see what happens. Until next time, do take care and bye for now.